You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to Marketing News Canada, Canada's number one show featuring the brightest minds in marketing, PR, and digital advertising.
Wouldn't it have been cool if you could have started a company with five of your fitness buddies, work your butts off, and one day your company raised $90 million from the likes of Mike Tyson, Francis Ngannou, and George St. Pierre? Well, that's exactly what happened with our next guest. Hey, I'm Ted, agency guy, and your host for today's episode of Marketing News Canada. Today on the show, we have Patrick Chandler, co-founder of Fight Camp, the at-home boxing company founded by a bunch of Canadians out of Quebec. Oh, and one American. Patrick's journey began as a mechanical engineering student, but when he and his co-founder secured a spot in Y Combinator, he made the bold decision to leave university behind and relocate from Montreal to San Francisco. Over the years, he's navigated the diverse landscape of manufacturing, machine learning, and marketing while spearheading the incredible growth of Fight Camp. Patrick, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me, Ted.
So, Quebecois, hey?
Yep, although I am admittedly the more anglophone of the team.
That's awesome.
I can speak
French,
but it's not tested as much as them.
I love when we have the pre-calls with our guests, and so the listeners won't know this, but you know, this is we talk on kind of video, and you know, I was like, oh, Fight Camp, that's a really cool thing. I use it, and da 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 da. And you're like, oh, yeah, no, I'm Canadian too, because you were asking me like, oh, where are you from? Like Vancouver. You're like, oh, I'm Canadian too. I'm like, really? And then like he like stands up slightly, and you see a Montreal Canadiens t-shirt. I'm like, fucking A, that's awesome. Oh, wait, I shouldn't be swearing. Frickin' A. That's awesome. And so y'all started it. You dropped out of school and you know, you were a mechanical engineering student, but you got into manufacturing, machine learning, and you're the CMO of the company. So how does that work?
Yeah, it's a really fun beginning story, because while I was in school, I was supposed to get a job in the summer, and I'd worked at this company for a few years, and it actually went under, didn't tell me, and I was like about to go to work. And then someone was like, hey, by the way, like the company you're about to go to is like no longer exists. And it was a mechanical engineering like job for a student. And so I literally just walked around campus, and I was like, I stumbled onto an event that was people wanting to start startups in their area. And I'm like, no one would hire a mechanical engineer for a startup. So I told everyone I was a software engineer.
You lied. Great. That's what all entrepreneurs do.
I have written software in the past. I wouldn't say I was great at it, but I had definitely done it. And so I went around and I told them what I had done in the software space. I had helped like one of my friends build a video game when we were kids for fun on a browser. And so I went around and I pitched that, and probably no one believed me. And then I got to the final person that was Khalil, our current CEO. And I said, no, 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 I'm a software person. And he goes, actually, we're looking for mechanical engineers. And I'm like, well, lo and behold, that is actually what I am studying. So that's the origin story of how we all kind of met. And that weird kind of, how do you go from, you know, mechanical engineering to at least talking about starting a company? It was job opportunity. I was like, let's make almost no money at a startup versus making no money not working this summer.
Yeah, I guess so. But then, I mean, how do you go from, okay, so yes, mechanical engineering instead of software, that's cool. But you did end up getting into machine learning. You started doing the marketing. I mean, I know when I started my company, you're the chief bottle washer, and you did kind of everything, right? But there were six of you. There are six of you, right? And so why would they get the mechanical engineering guy to do marketing and machine learning?
Yeah, it's possibly a non-traditional path, but you'd be surprised how many CMOs I meet that have a background in engineering, because it does tend to look a bit like a black box system you want to figure out. So you're like, hey, we have to do some sort of input that's media buying, marketing, positioning, something happens in the middle with the consumer, and then you get sales at the end. So to try to figure out from a systems approach of measurement and analytics, as the company gets bigger and more complex, the engineering background does start to creep back in. So I do quite a bit of, like, let's call it analytics, data, a little bit more analyzing problems from an engineering perspective than I do from a pure marketing perspective. But the big question is, how do you go from one to the other? So in the beginning, it's kind of the classic startup story is you just try to solve the biggest problem and you move on one at a time. So in the beginning, it was, we're a hardware company. We wanted to build something that was a new tool for boxing. So the very beginning of the product was literally just, boxing's really old. Like, everyone's just like, punch a bag until your arms hurt. No measurements, no way of knowing if you're getting better. Fitbit was getting very big then with pedometers and, like, okay, you can actually track running now. So we had the idea that let's try to track boxing. And so when I joined, the view was, hey, let's just do some, let's call it mechanical engineering stuff, velocity calculations, motion, kind of like, you throw a punch, how fast was it? And then that immediately led to, wait, how do you define what a punch is? And then that actually opened up the whole software sphere of machine learning. It's like, okay, if you look at the data, you could write a bunch of really ugly if statements of, if the motion looks like this, it maybe is a jab or a hook, or you can get a machine to do that. So that was one of the first big transitions where I went from, okay, I can do velocity because that's something I learned in all my classes. Now the next one is, what's a block? What's a parry? What's, the person just moving their hand without thinking about it? And what's actually a punch that they're throwing to hit someone? And so that was the first transition. And I'll stop there, Ted, because that's a bit of a big one of going from mechanical engineering to machine learning. And then that was the biggest problem at the time.
That's really cool. And then so one, there's okay, was it five people from Quebec and from Canada and one from America, but then, not a lot of people. Sure, there's a lot of folks that apply and get accepted to Y Combinator, but they don't get the success that you guys have had. So where was that journey from Montreal to San Francisco? How does that work?
Yeah, I think, when you're in that startup ecosystem, Montreal had a nice startup ecosystem. We were at a co-working space and we were seeing all these other people build their businesses. We started to meet a few people who have built businesses through Y Combinator. And so we're like, you know what? Let's just apply for it. We didn't really have a product out there. We didn't really know our users yet. So we wrote a video, submitted it, and of course, rejected.
Rejected. Oh, the first time you got rejected.
Yeah, first time got rejected. And then we didn't give up. I think it was 6 months later. We definitely understood the customer a lot better. We understood a little bit more about what we wanted to build. And then we hit our submission in there. And they're like, yeah, you know what? Come down and we'll do the in-person, which for us was like, every time you look back, it's like everything just felt so crazy big. And then you look back, someone asking to go to a meeting doesn't feel that big anymore. But we went down there, and that was a huge trip for us. That was, for some people, like, very rarely do we travel and go to places like San Francisco, coming and growing up in Montreal. I had never been. And so we went down there, got to do the interview, showed off kind of, let's call it, I would say the two roles. I want to say Paul Graham we're a big fan of, which is relentless and resourceful were the two things we showed off in those meetings, which is like, we've pivoted so many times into our business, tried different things in such a short amount of time, and anything that got in our way, we found a way around it. Hence, going from mechanical engineering to machine learning is like, hey, we can't just bring a machine learning person in. We have to figure it out ourselves. So I think showing off that really got us through into that one. And luckily in our batch, there was a lot of hardware companies. And for those that don't know, hardware companies are hard. And the reason is software. If you build a piece of software, you can give it to everyone in the world tomorrow. If you build a piece of hardware like us, it took us like 4 years to get it into Canada, for example,
right?
Because there's a lot of physical regulations. There's a lot of shipping costs. There's a lot of demand in that specific area you have to build up over time. So hardware is hard, which is why the six-person founding team makes a little bit more sense when you look at a context of a hardware company, because you have manufacturing, firmware, like the actual hardware design of the board itself. Now you have logistics, distribution, you have like obviously customer service, marketing, product, app. Like those are just the pieces. So almost each founder mapped one-to-one with each kind of like big area of the business we needed to be good at.
So how do you guys, I mean, it took quite some time before I would imagine you were monetizing. Maybe I'm wrong, but enough to pay six people. Like it sounds like your story a little bit like a rock band, right? Hey, and then yet all six of you founders kind of stayed on as opposed to, you know, the fifth Beatle, you know, that kind of dropped off before success came. So how were you feeding yourselves? What did you do to stay focused before you started? Oh, hey, crap, this is a real thing.
Yeah, I would say like obviously getting funding from Y Combinator gave us a bit of breathing room, but it's like $120,000. I think they've changed the amount that they can give now, but it was $120,000 back in the day. And yeah, six people, that's not a lot of money. Especially looking at the current lifestyle that the world requires of groceries and all those economic pieces. But what I would say is we all lived together. So we moved to San Francisco. We all lived in one house. So we paid one bit of rent and we worked out of that office as well. So like we would go sleep, we'd wake up, we'd go down to this giant table in the main living room and we'd all work out of there. So like rent was pooled between all of us. For food, we would actually do like group cooking. So like me, I would cook for a few people in the house, build like big meals the beginning of the week. I was vegetarian, so you can actually make a lot of meals really, really cheaply. And then I got really into Soylent, which back in the day when it was the powder, this is like the most San Francisco tech bro thing I will ever say. But like to save money and to be more efficient, I would drink a lot of Soylent, like straight from the powder when it tasted like pancake mix and Cheerio milk. And so that would sustain us. But yeah, we basically lived paying ourselves almost no money, basically just enough to maybe go get a meal every week and enough for groceries. So at the beginning, yeah, hyper dedication. All of us believed in the mission, the vision. It was the six of us just trying to make things work. And to answer your question of like, how long did it take to monetize? The tough thing about hardware, but something we did solve early on, was we could actually build prototypes. And we weren't afraid to sell them. YC is a big fan of like the best validation is someone buying the thing. So they basically told us like, hey, you have all these like nice things and you're testing them with people. Why don't you ask people to pay for them? So that was a big push to be like, okay, it's true. Like they're ugly and they're prototypey, but would people pay for these? So some of the early people we worked with, like the Canadian Olympic team, US Olympic team, we went up to a few of them are like high level coaches. We said, hey, this is, I feel like we sold the first one for like $300-$400, which at the time was like, wow, we actually monetized this. Like that's amazing. But they were ready to pay for it. And so that's also how you kind of know, okay, we're solving a real need. If they just want to give us feedback, that's like, I think there's a book about this called like the mom test. So I'm like, oh, that's nice, honey. Like a lot of people look at your startup and go, oh, wow, that's cool. But then you go, are you willing to pay X amount of dollars to get the services we're offering? That's when you get real validation in the market that there's actually something there. And so in the beginning, that was what we did. We bought 3D printers. We made the hardware. We handmade the boards ourselves. Hand soldered batteries onto the boards we were getting fabbed near us and built everything kind of like, I remember I made molds and I would like mix silicon and inject them. And we'd literally make the trackers, 3D printed everything, and then injection molded ourselves. And we just give them to people for like $300-$400 and say, hey, this is a beta. This is not going to be pretty, but we'll replace them if they break. Early monetization was actually something we pushed to do and I think did well, especially as a hardware company. It's very hard to just ship, right? It's like shipping code is like, you know, git commit, go for it. But this one is a lot more like you actually have to sit down and physically assemble stuff and then physically ship it to people. And that is a burden. Even in the beginning, we bought an $1,000 3D printer and that was a big conversation. I was like, hey guys, like this is like 2% of the money in our bank account. Are we willing to do that for this? And so we had to quickly turn it around and make, I think we made a few thousand within the month off of the early adopters we were going after to sell the product. So that was a big learning, getting in people's hands as well. That's invaluable feedback, right? People being like, hey, I'm running into issues, not with the actual hardware, but with understanding the metrics, or you're not showing the right information for me. So hardware company, even though it's hard, you do have to get in people's hands. So learn how to prototype and build early versions. Don't do the classic mistake where you manufacture first, and then you get in people's hands and they go, this misses the mark. And you go, well, there goes the company.
So that's great. I mean, sounds like you guys got your hands dirty, literally cooking as well. You were the chef. And then you also got into just testing, getting the prototypes and selling them. And I think a lot of folks, and I mean, I in my day, I see a lot of startups that will try to build it before they come kind of thing, right? The whole field of dreams where guys are like,
if you build it, they will come is like the classic fallacy.
Yeah. It was the classic fallacy. So that's fantastic. Okay. So let's talk about how you meet Mike Tyson or how you get George St. Pierre to come and help you guys. And I mean, if you look at, if anyone goes to the fight camp, any of their social media, Mike Tyson's all over it. So how does that work? How do you get in touch with those people? You being the marketer, were you the person, you know, selling Big Mike? What were you doing? Iron Mike, I think?
Yep, Iron Mike. And I'll start with the George St. Pierre one because it's the most Canadian story, I would say, of the bunch. And then I'll briefly go through the Mike one. But the George St. Pierre one started really, really early. Now, this is like one of the more long play investments we ever did. Back in the day when we had almost no money and we were in Quebec working for $50 a seat at a co-working space, we saw that George St. Pierre was doing a session at one of the gyms nearby and doing like a little talk and kind of like a meet and greet. So Khalil and I, so the CEO and myself, were like, let's go there and try to convince him to invest or like try to show him, like we had nothing at this point. So this is like way, way early. So we show up to this event, and I don't know if you've like ever been to meet and greets. You get like 3 seconds with the person, right? There's no way you're going to be able to pitch a business and be like, hey, would you invest? So on the car ride there, we're talking about like realistically, what do we think is going to happen? And so we came up with a strategy that was go there, try to find out, like find his manager, find the people he talks to a lot, and try to convince one of them that it's worth the time to talk about it.
Hmm.
And so that was our strategy. It's like we got a nice photo with George and everything, but there's no way in the 2 seconds you're standing next to him and someone's snapping a photo, you could be like, hey, Mike, hey, George, do you want to invest? So we met his manager, which was named Rodolphe, and we just started contacting him continuously, and we didn't close anything for years. So like that was a huge early investment. In our view, didn't pan out in the beginning, but then years and years later, we're like, huh, we still have this person that we've talked to back in the day. So we pulled it back in when we were raising money with an actual business at the time. Back then, we literally were just like, we have an idea about trackers for boxing. Do you want to invest? So as time went on, we got more sophisticated and raised a round. And then we're like, you know what? Let's open this round to people that we wish we could have in the round. So that's when we got the George St. Pierre, the Francis Ngannou, the Mike Tyson of it. And that George one came from, that early kind of like call it a Hail Mary of let's show up at a meet and greet and try to pitch someone our business. And
well, I love the idea though. Like it sounds like you guys did not let failure even remotely hinder you. I mean, you applied to Y Combinator, got rejected, right? And then did it again. You started these prototypes and you had to like, figure out how we're going to do the injection mold. And now we're going to spend 2% of our bank account. And then you go in for shits and giggles. They can beep me out for saying that. You basically went and tried to hook up with this guy who's, you know, a Canadian superstar as you were. And they were like, yeah, no, you have an idea. Good luck. And then you came back, well, I guess what, 2 years, 3 years later?
Something like that.
Did you stay connected with them or just?
Yep. Yeah, we always wanted to do something with them, but like, it's very hard to convince someone like invest in this thing that we don't even know what it is yet. Right. Like, so we're still in the exploration phase of like, who's our real market? Is this a big business? And so at a certain point, like you do have to realize like, they don't want to invest in a super uncertain thing, right? The world doesn't really want to do that, especially if you're not like an institutional investor or an angel investor that's actively looking to catch the early wave of something. You probably want to get them somewhere probably near the middle where it's like, okay, de-risked enough, right? This isn't going to be like a, you know, a 1% chance of success. We're in the 10 to 20% chance of success field because they can't spread themselves out too thin like maybe a seed investor or an angel investor could. And so, yeah, that was the... a very interesting one. I will say like the Paul Graham one always sticks with me of the relentlessly resourceful aspect of entrepreneurship, which is just like you said, when you run into something, how do you find your way around it? And as a hardware company, you know, it was very unique. Our CTO, I would say, is like genius level on both hardware and software, which is always nice to have. And so we didn't outsource almost anything about the product development in the beginning. So that's a huge blessing, because if you just give you perspective, to get someone to build an Android app that would do what we wanted to do would cost us $120,000, which was all the money in our bank account. Mm-hmm. So instead, we had our incredibly intelligent CTO basically learn how to build the app and then build it. And so a lot of these times we'd run into a problem, and you, as a startup, you don't have cash to spend on these things. So you can't just be like, oh, just bring in a person who's an expert at this. So all of us had to become experts in different things. And so I'll take the segue to say, and this is why I got into marketing, is we couldn't just hire someone who's a genius at marketing. We needed to use the people we had, and we needed to give them the opportunity to learn how to do something that's valuable to the business, that was most impactful. And at that time, when I was looking at the problem, I had done the machine learning piece. We had built the algorithm that could track what type of punch you're throwing. The next step is, okay, how do we build prototypes for it? So I worked on the 3D printing with my mech eng background. Like, that was, you know, 3D modeling and things like that were roughly in my forte. But then after that, it was like, wait, all that's done now. Now we're going to, like, we know how to make it. You know, the algorithms are at a good place. Now, how do we get people to buy this? And so I did a deep dive, and I'm like, okay, let me figure out marketing, which looking back, like, you're not going to figure that in a very short amount of time. Mm-hmm. But I started doing Facebook ads, started working on website optimizations, Shopify pages, and just really dug into it with incredible urgency and a lot of relentless resourcefulness to try to figure out, talking to tons of people. YC is amazing at that. We connected with so many people who are so much smarter than me at all these areas. And I just listened, asked questions, and tried to absorb, and then try stuff myself. So that was the beginning. That was how I made the transition to marketing and eventually becoming the CMO of the company. I started as the chief data scientist, just doing algorithm work and maybe mechanical engineering work. And then we're like, hey, we need someone to really understand this and figure it out, because especially as you scale, it's one of the biggest levers and biggest risks you have. So if someone gives you, you know, 20, 50, $70 million, a good chunk of that's going into growth through marketing. And so if you don't have a really good data-driven approach at it, and a way to be like, here's where I know where we're doing well, and here's where I know we're doing poorly on using the budget, they say growth is guaranteed when you raise funding. If you do not grow after raising funding, something's wrong, because even inefficient spend will lead to some level of growth. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So like, they're basically saying, like, there's an expectation of growth here, and your job is to make it as efficient as possible, to make those dollars stretch as far as possible. And I would say that engineering background really helped there, because a lot of times if you go to a market and you say, tell me if this channel is working or not, and that person is maybe working on that channel, it's very easy to make the case that every channel is working. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm like, oh yeah, we saw more increase in branded search campaign because of our TV ads we're running. And you go, but is it actually incremental to the business? If we turn it off, does the business suffer significantly? And those kinds of bigger questions come from a testing framework that I really enjoyed through my time in engineering. So it's, you're really just trying to figure out, what is the real lever you have here? What should you be doubling down on? Where are you good? Where are you bad? So I'll stop there on that.
I mean, that's great. So there was a lot of testing, and I think a lot of marketers do, is, was there like a particular aha moment when you're like, oh, that worked, let's double down on that? Or, oh, I should have done this more. Or there was this learning that made you go, okay, this is where we put the fuel in the fire.
Yeah, I will. I'll break that into two. So the first part is, like, you mentioned, like, every marketer is pretty much like, yeah, we do testing. But in my perspective, not all testing is the same. So you do have to maybe be a little more aggressive with, like, be really honest with yourself when you write the hypotheses for certain things, and be like, here's what we believe is going to happen, and here's how we're measuring. And if that doesn't happen, just walk away. Like, there is this view that it happens to, like, even within our team, like, even when I think about this a lot, this still happens over and over again, where we think because something has changed that a channel we've tried multiple times will suddenly start working again. And it could be a mix of, like, people want to try something new, right? There's some attractiveness about, like, let's get on TikTok, for example. Like, everyone's on TikTok. But then when you start to dig in, you go, like, ask the smart question of, well, how much are you actually spending on TikTok? And is this just a test for other companies just to get a gauge? Because most people, it's not getting close more than like 10% of their media mix. So even though they're saying they're getting it, it's kind of like the, you know, like a bragging about, oh, we figured it out. When it's like, if you figure it out, you should be spending 50 to 60% of your money there. So I think people can figure it out at a very small scale. But so the question on like how to think through good testing to me comes down to exactly that point of like, you can make any channel in a certain lens look good. So if you look at TV and you go, let's check the awareness lift of TV, it's probably going to be better than Facebook ads. But is mm-hmm. that matter for mm-hmm. the business? So I took a very far away approach and I said, we're just going to do how'd you hear about us surveys. That is the number one source of truth. After someone buys, we're going to put in a lot of work to mm-hmm. make sure we get a lot of people to answer the how did you hear about us survey. We're going to make it custom that you can give us really detailed answers. And then we're going to do a fallback that's like, if you click through a UTM, we're going to give that one credit if they did not answer the how'd you hear about us survey. So that was our baseline. And what I said with that was, if we cannot prove a channel works purely on how'd you hear about us, like people saying, like we turn on TV, we should hear people say it was TV. And if we don't see enough of that, we just walk away. And that was a very good forcing function around like first set like realistic benchmarks. If you turn on TV, don't expect similar to Facebook CAC within the first week. Maybe within 8 weeks, you're getting double the CAC of Facebook. So we'd always kind of set this like wave of like when you turn on an ad, like we did a waterfall, it's like 5% buy in the first week, and then it's, you know, 20% by the second week, and then 50% by the fourth week. So you do see if you turn on media spend, you should expect kind of this wave of people joining because of that new channel. And we just wanted to be really, let's say, intentional about the way we looked at it. And if you could not prove it through this specific lens, even if we're wrong, like even if this is incremental to the business and better for us, if we cannot prove it through this one lens that I'm paying the most attention to, it's not worth it for now. So we're not a brand awareness company. We are a direct response. We need people to buy within 4 to 8 weeks. So if you cannot prove that people are saying, I heard about you through this new media channel you're doing to a certain level, we walk away from it. So that was how you get kind of a more detailed view of like, okay, don't just say, hey, try any test to prove this. Don't just do a geo holdout here and prove that it worked in this one geo in this one moment. If you launch it and it's not showing up in the how'd you hear about us, for me, it was something we would just say no to.
You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand, and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So then how do you manage we had the pandemic, there was the fitness side of things where, you know, the Pelotons of the world skyrocketed. And so how do you validate some of the science, the intention, whatever you called it, you know, to do that, because like Peloton, just everyone was stuck at home. So they got a bike, and now Peloton is not doing so well. Like, how did you, one, validate some of your hypotheses over that wave? And then now, given people are not, at least from what I understand, buying Pelotons, like I'm assuming you guys got affected as well.
Yeah. So relative to like, I'm guessing you're talking about like, how did we measure the effectiveness of channels during COVID versus after COVID?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So
see, you're way more articulate. You should be a host too. Did you learn to be a podcast host at the same time while you were cooking and doing machine learning and marketing?
Nope. No. That's the one area I'm a firm believer of. I will only be a guest, no hosting.
For now.
But yeah, what I would say is like the great thing about the How'd You Hear About It is it actually does give you a better view into that. And you have to remember too, like I think it was just a little bit after COVID, iOS 14.5 hit, which basically removed a lot of people's lenses to look at the efficiency of some of these channels because of the way that it was blocking a lot of data that people were using to make decisions within the channels. So when COVID hit, it increased the efficiency of ads because more people were interested from the same audience. If I targeted 1,000 people that looked like you, and then during COVID and I targeted the same 1,000, about twice as many people were willing, 2 to 3 times actually, were willing to convert out of that audience just because all the other options have been removed. You can't go to a physical gym. You know, you can't maybe go as far out of your city or something like to go to the classes. So all that happened. So what it did is our How'd You Hear About a survey, we saw a spike in like a reduction in customer acquisition costs for each channel and a spike, but only for specific channels. There were some channels that were affected more or less than others. And oftentimes I would say like paid social is the one that's the most, is really good at finding that audience that's resonating right now. So like when COVID hit, it probably found a lot more people who were like, hey, I used to be at a boxing gym. I never would have bought this product. Now things have changed. My behavior on Facebook or Instagram is highlighting this. They're a good audience now. So the How'd You Hear About Us lens, when you take all the way back, everything increased in conversion rate, but not everything scaled the same. So then you could see the opportunity. And for us, it was in paid social during the pandemic. So we went hard there, did a little bit of TV, did a little bit of influencer, a lot of other places that gained efficiency. So channels that wouldn't work the year before were now suddenly working, because the critical mass in the audience is bigger, or at least there is a critical mass in the audience. So if you run a TV campaign, oh, well, actually, everyone is your customer now. Hmm. Whereas before, if someone had decided they're not an at-home workout person, bam, your audience is cut in half in terms of efficiency. So that was there. And then as soon as the pandemic slowed down, we did start to see that in our data. And that's when we pulled off certain channels. That's when we started pulling off. So like we did start to see, like as gyms reopened, the efficiency lost in paid social, in influencer TV, podcast, and so we pulled off of them to the point that it came back to kind of an equilibrium point.
Okay. So tell me about how on the PR side, on the advertising side, you're getting exposure because you're a bit of a unicorn, a bit of a darling, and you know you got exposure on Forbes and whatnot. But being a Canadian group of founders, you know, we were talking in the pre-show about, you know, some misconceptions or misquotations. How do you manage that? Do you just laugh it off? Do you have any stories?
Oh yeah, definitely a lot of stories. So oftentimes, especially in the beginning, I feel like this is Michael Seibel that told me this when you're at Y Combinator. And it was basically when someone's interviewing for a PR article, like, and you're going on a show or you're going to be interviewed, you should just have a list in front of you that is the incredibly simple 1 or 2 points you want them to take away. And no matter what they ask, you just go back to those 1 or 2 points. Because the problem is if you say 100 things, they're going to choose what are the 100 things they're going to remember and they're going to talk about. So you might do a big like exactly like this podcast. We're going to speak for like 30, 40 minutes, and you might choose a voice clip that's like, really mediocre to the message I'm trying to get out. I don't actually have a message in this one, but if I did, I would kind of try to always bring it back to the 1 or 2 things I want you to actually write about and not talk about too much other than that. Because what often happens is we'll have an article come out and they'll focus on something that means nothing to us. So that's the first one where we'll read an article and they'll be like, wow, they really cared about this weird specific angle that someone just kind of mentioned offhand. And that's the entire like hook of the article. And it's nothing to do with what we actually want people to know. So to give an example, we may have done something in the past that we don't do anymore. Like we offered a solution for gyms And an article might talk all about that, even though we were just saying that's what we used to do. And now we're selling directly to consumers. And the article is just all about the gym. And you're like, wait. I know you wanted to write about the gym because that's something you wanted to write about. But really, it doesn't benefit both parties if the message they put out to the world has nothing to do with what you want the consumer to understand about your business. So it's as if they write like, this is made for professional fighters in their article, which has been written about us before. They're like, this product is for high-level amateurs and professionals. If that's not true, you want to make sure they stick to kind of, if you are a consumer reading this, how do you get the most value out of this business? How do you understand it in your context? We want them to say, this is for beginners. This is for everyone. So you just have to be careful with what you say. And then on top of that, when they're looking for extra facts in the story, they'll sometimes stretch the truth. Sometimes, especially probably now with ChatGPT, they'll say things that are just straight up hallucinated, I would say. So one of the funny ones was we had an early article. And I remember the funny thing too was it was Tommy, who's from Boston. So the American founder was running PR, and he got a story out there that basically said all of the Canadian founders met at the University of Canada. And like that was just like an intro line of the story. And Tommy felt so bad because he's like, I didn't tell them that. Like, I didn't just say there's some magical one university in Canada that you guys all met at, because we didn't meet at a university necessarily. Like a few of us met when they were younger, and then I met like at an event. So like there actually is no like university tie-in. And I think the person writing the article just wanted a really quick summary of like, how did they meet each other? They met at the University of Canada, which for those, I don't know, I think your audience is fairly Canadian, but those that don't know, that is not a university.
So basically you're telling me if someone applies to Ballistic Arts, my company, and says, I went to the University of Canada, that I should probably think twice about hiring them? Yeah, okay.
Or you got to check which one. Is it the University of Canada Montreal or the University of Canada Toronto?
Which campus? That's right. So then what about the future of marketing for y'all? You guys have kind of went from, I think, 60 founders to now, I think, 50 some odd staff. So what's next on the horizon from a marketing perspective?
Yeah, I think, there's always a good tension between how much are you going to pay for growth and how much are you going to get growth through specific product initiatives or like launching new things. So there's always that push and pull of like, how long can you sell or rely on paid channels to get you growth? I definitely subscribe close to maybe some of the Reforge topics on this, which are around like paid media is the catalyst, or let's say the fire that lights a bigger engine for you. So you have to think of it, at least in my view, in two ways. Is how is your paid media getting you towards a critical mass of people that then spins up a flywheel that is not reliant on paid? Because at the end of the day, like, I don't know, it's my own perspective, you don't want to pay for growth forever. And if only you're only paying for growth, like, I got news for you, someone's going to raise more and they're going to beat you on paid growth. But if you actually build a useful product to the market, you're solving a real need, referral goes up, people are writing about you, people are talking about you, don't have to pay every time someone's promoting your product. That's when you start to get into that space. And I think if you design a product in a way that the referral becomes, let's say, makes the product more enjoyable or more fun for you, that's the best referral, right? Not a paid incentive referral, but one that's like, hey, if you join this, it makes my life easier. The classics, Slack, Asana, all these ones are like, if you join Slack, it makes both of our lives easier. Slack doesn't need to pay me to tell you that, right? It's like, you're just going to naturally spread it out. So there are some products and companies that if with just a tweak, product growth can come, but it needs to be started with some level of, let's say, paid marketing growth. So I do find that oftentimes I try to work equally on both sides, which is how do we get paid media to be efficient, knowing that CACs are only going to go up, right? Like the more you spend, it's always on a diminishing return curve. So unless you're increasing lifetime value for each person, which allows you to spend more on your customer acquisition, you're probably not going to be a great business unless you have that second side, which is the more people we get into our product, the more people love us and refer us. That should offset your CAC as you scale. So to me, that's the way I think about it, is if you're only focused on one and you're just a top of funnel, I need more people to buy my product. But as a marketer, you're not thinking, what are the unmet needs of the consumer? And how are we actually communicating that to product or whoever's building the thing so we can actually solve those better? You're going to always be stuck with the, you scale up spend, it costs more, you have to scale back. You scale up spend, it costs money to scale back. When you could have taken some of that funding or some of that time and energy and put it onto talking to customers. Hey, what are we missing the mark on here? Or what are you buying instead of us and why? Like, those to me are the most insightful ones of like, you know, we don't beat Peloton in terms of a fun at-home workout for most of the audience, but we beat Peloton in terms of a workout when people are like, hey, I want a non-traditional workout. I don't like biking. I don't like running. I don't like weights. We win that audience. So the more you talk to that audience, the more you realize they have a specific set of needs. They want a more three-dimensional movement baked into. These are the kind of people who would maybe do like a lot more yoga classes or things that are more like, I want to just not sit on a machine and just push a thing. They want to actually evolve their body, get better, and get use out of the motion. So once you understand that that's the audience, you can start building a product that really satisfies those needs so you can capture more of that. You don't want to be the, let's beat Peloton on every facet, because to be honest, they're going to win. Hey, I want to bike in my house. Like, Fight Camp's not going to compete for people who are completely fine biking in their house. Like, so there's no sense in killing yourself trying to market to them. Figure out that group that really loves you, build a really good product for them, and then you get that flywheel going. Now, every person that is into non-traditional workouts is going to say to their other friend who's into non-traditional workouts, hey, you should try this out because it's so much better. So that's what has allowed us to scale to certain degrees, because if we're just relying on paid media, that diminishing return curve is brutal.
Yeah, you know, I agree. And it's, I think there's a book called The Blue Ocean Strategy, and I think it talks a little bit about that too, right? That you're not competing head on with some of the big people in the sphere, and see where you can really leverage and find your target. And quite frankly, that's funny enough. I'm a Fight Camp. I don't know. What do you call them? Fight Camp camper. I don't know.
You're a Fight Camp user. You're a Fight Camp member.
I'm a Fight Camp user. And we were talking the pre-call, because I would have used it a lot longer, but you couldn't get the trackers up to Canada. And that's where we started talking about how you're actually Canadian. And you thought it was funny that, you know, Canadians can get it. But now I did get my tracker. But I, you know, I have a martial arts background, and being in my mid 40s, you know, it's not great to go and do martial arts while, you know, it's especially during COVID. I wasn't going to do any martial arts, period. But, you know, getting old and whatnot, I just wanted to kind of be active, not really wanting to sit on a bike, though I do have a spin bike. I don't have a Peloton, but I have a spin bike. But it was, how do I get up? And also, you know, sometimes, you know, running a marketing agency can be tough. So like, rather than sitting on a bike and getting my frustration up, punching something, kicking something is much nicer, and having something to track my progress really made it for me a lot more fun, a lot more engaging, because sometimes when you punch a bag, you get your frustrations out, but you know, getting your frustrations out might only take 5-10 minutes. And then what is that the end of the workout? But like, having something like this and someone that, you know, kind of talking you through it and having a little bit of communal competition, I think it's been fun. So I really commend you guys for doing that. Maybe we'll go quickly to our rapid fire round, because, you know, we're kind of limited on time, and just to get a little bit to know about Patrick. So, best place to get smoked meat sandwich in Montreal.
I'm a vegan, but Schwartz's for sure. But
yeah, so I used to be a meat eater. I'm a vegan now too. I remember you said you're vegetarian, but I gotta ask anyway. You're from Montreal, okay? So where's the best vegan place to eat in? Well, you're in LA now. You're in Costa Mesa, right? Costa Mesa.
Now I'm in Hollywood, but yeah,
you're in Hollywood. Okay, best place to eat in Hollywood that's vegan.
Okay, there's a, I'll shout out to Palms Thai. I'm right on the edge of Thai Town, and there's this amazing Thai food place. And Thai food is great vegan because they use a lot of like coconut as substitutes for milk and tons of just spicy vegetables and things. So I would say Palms Thai if you're ever in the Hollywood. It's right at the end of the Walk of Fame. So,
oh, nice.
Right there.
Nice. I'll go next time in LA. We go to Gracias Madre in West Hollywood.
They're good too.
Really good queso there, and good everything, quite frankly.
Yeah, it's a nut queso, right? It's like based on cashew or something. Right.
We could geek out about vegan food all day long, but I think we're going to lose some of the audience.
Lose the audience, okay.
Favorite thing that you guys did to keep from going insane when you guys were just six of you sitting, you know, in that one apartment. What did you guys do for fun? because you couldn't go out and go to eat and whatnot, right? So what did you do?
We would still go to the bar every once in a while, but we would drink at home and then go to the bar. We wouldn't drink at the bar.
Did you your own booze too? Is that what you end up doing?
No, but coming to the States from Canada, two things that were really funny is A, we didn't know where to buy alcohol. Like there's no SAQ. So in Quebec, there's an SAQ and there's the beer store and all these places there. When we first landed in the States, we would go into like a grocery store or like, where were we? We were in New York. And I think you had to buy them in like specific places, the CVS, which like I wouldn't go to a pharmacy to buy my alcohol. So that never crossed my mind. And someone's like, oh, just go to the pharmacy to get all your alcohol. I'm like, oh, wow. Yeah, that's wild. Like hard alcohols and things, like it was just an absolute thing. We'd go to like the corner stores and they wouldn't have this, right? The corner store selling alcohol in the States is like not a common thing. They have a liquor store, which is very different. So we couldn't find it as easy, but then we found a few brands and we're like, oh my God, they have like multiple liters of wine at like pharmacies. And we would just go there for like $5 to get multiple liters of wine. So early days, that was how we maybe blew off some steam, as we would drink together and then go to a bar and hang out. So that was fun. And then I would say we were not great communicators early on, but we wanted to work on it. So we would go for long bike rides together was another one. We all had bikes. We had no car. Well, we had one car between like the six of us. And so we would bike a lot of places and kind of try to get outdoors every once in a while. But yeah, tempers did flare. And I would say the thing that kept us all together is the willingness to always work it out, even if we were kind of tough to work with sometimes. We just had I don't know. We've been together for so long that I don't even remember how we really stuck together, but there's moments where we're almost, you know, almost walked away. And oftentimes it just comes from someone being willing to have a tough conversation and be like, hey, you know, I think that was a shitty thing, or, you know, here's how we should communicate through these. So we worked on that. We got coaching, and YC definitely a big help. I think anytime we ran into really tough founder conflict, YC was a great sounding board around it. And they have a philosophy that I think is called Iterated Prisoner's Dilemma, which is a fun one to think through. If you guys don't know that one.
I don't know that one. What was it? Say that again.
I think it's called Iterated Prisoner's Dilemma, which is basically the prisoner's dilemma is two people who, like, if one of them tells on the other one and that person like keeps their mouth shut, the other person does a ton of jail time, this one goes away for free. And it's but if you both say that you both did it, you both do medium time. And so it's this trade-off of like, when should you be nice and when should you not be nice? And so the view of Iterated Prisoner's Dilemma is, imagine that game, but you have to play it over and over again. And you know what the person did last time. So you're just, basically the goal is, if you're always kind of being a jerk, the other person's going to realize that and they're always just going to be a jerk back. And so it's in the context of like, should you screw over your co-founder in any meaningful way? The question is, are you likely going to run into that person again in a way that you need them to be on the other side of the table? Mm. And generally speaking, especially in the startup world, if you start to be shitty with co-founders start to be bad with co-founders, or like make like obvious mean moves within the company, you're going to run into them later in your career anyway, or you're going to run into them in the ecosystem, and then they're going to remember what you did and they're going to hit you back with the same kind of like, I'm not going to trust you this time.
So it's kind of like just a realization of, you know, karma can bite you in the butt.
And especially given like the startup ecosystem being so small, like, karma is guaranteed to come
will,
back.
Will guarantee. Yeah. It's not can, it will. All right. Yeah. Got it. Okay. Hey, so where can we find you guys? Tell us. Plug the company.
Yep. No, definitely. So like joinfightcamp.com or even fightcamp.com works. You can go check out what we offer. Right now we are getting into Canada. We're available for most of the United States currently, I think, except like maybe Hawaii and potentially Alaska. But in Canada, we're trackers. You can buy them in BC, in Ontario, and in Alberta. And we're just getting the bag now up into Ontario. So if you're in Ontario, the bag's there. If you're in BC or Alberta, wait a little bit. And then probably in a few months, we'll figure out how to get to the rest of Canada. But we're doing it fairly slowly just to make sure we're opening the right markets at the right times. But yeah, basically, if you want a quick summary, if you want to do boxing at home or kickboxing, we offer guided workouts from trainers, all filmed down here in Costa Mesa, and punch tracking technology on top of it, that as you're doing the workout, you can see the number of punches you're throwing, the average velocities of your punches, the output of that workout, and you're going to be following along to a series of combinations that the trainer is going to teach you. So if you have no experience in boxing, we have tons of tutorials that get you up to speed to know it. So you don't need to be like Ted coming in with decent experience. If you just want something that's, if you're bored with running, biking, weights, and all your friends are like, they're so easy and fun to do. And you're like, I want something different and I actually want to enjoy what I'm doing and have fun. I think Fight Camp could be a great one for you guys. So I would check that out. And, you know, if anything, maybe just try local boxing around you. And then if you really do like it, Fight Camp is the best thing you can do to continue boxing at home.
Amen. All right, Patrick. Hey, it was a pleasure to meet you. When I'm down next in Hollywood, West Hollywood, we'll grab some bites and you can show me around your hood.
Yes. Grab some Thai food. Thank you, Ted.
Grab some Thai food. All right, man. Have a good one. Thank you, everyone, for listening to Marketing News Canada. I'm Ted, and this is Patrick, and we're signing out. See ya.
Thanks for listening to Marketing News Canada. For more episodes and other great stories from Canadian marketers, visit marketingnewscanada.com. All episodes are recorded at the Jelly Marketing Studio, thanks to our producer, Chris Penner, and editor, Travis Jeffers.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.